When the imposter was invited to do a show out in Abbotsford, British Columbia, I Googled the city. I found out that it had the most churches of any city in Canada, that the Pope once held a mass at the airport, and that there was this little piece of real estate that I had to see.
Remax Colonial Pacific.
Hi, I was just wondering if Paul Quinn is in.
He's in, but he's in a meeting. Could I transfer you to Chris Walters, his partner?
Sure.
Okay, one second.
Chris Walters.
Hi, Chris. My name is Aaliyah Pabani, and I'm calling from Canada Land Media.
Yes?
And the reason I'm calling is that I host this podcast called The Imposter.
Mm-hmm.
And we're heading to Abbotsford this weekend to do a live show at the university there that'll turn into an episode of our podcast.
Yeah.
And the reason I was calling is because I'm a big fan of Chad Kroeger.
Yeah.
And I understand that his mansion that he once owned is listed for sale, and I was wondering if it would be possible to do a tour of the place for the podcast.
We've had a couple of requests in order to shoot shows and stuff in the house, and the current owner has shied away from it.
I mean, it's an audio podcast, so it wouldn't be like video at all.
Yeah, for us to travel out there just to, you know, have a podcast is probably not going to happen.
Is it possible to speak to either you or Paul a little bit about the property for the podcast?
Paul knows the property far better than I do, so why don't I take your number, Aaliyah, and I'll get him to give you a shout when he's got a minute.
That would be great. Thank you.
You bet.
Hi, I called earlier from Canada Land Media, and I was wondering if Paul Quinn was in now.
He's out of the office right now. Can I take a message? Paul's probably going to be out all day. Paul Quinn's office. They're both out at meetings right now.
I didn't get into Chad Kroeger's mansion, but I found someone who did.
Hello.
Hi, is this Brad?
Speaking.
Hi, this is Aaliyah calling back.
Hey, Aaliyah.
So I'm just going to kind of pop the question right off the bat. Do you know Chad Kroeger?
Yes, I do.
And how did you meet? Can you give me kind of the origin story?
I used to be the bar manager of a bar out in Maple Ridge, and years ago, Chad and a few of his friends were our Monday night rock and roll house band.
What? Oh my, was it like the Nickelback early days, or was it a different band?
No, it was before Nickelback. They were actually, the guys were all still working at Starbucks at the time.
All of them.
Well, most of them. It seemed like the entire band worked at Starbucks for the longest time.
And did you ever have like the big band kind of play your...
Back at the bar?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. I'll always defend Chad as far as like when some people give him a bad rap. I had a couple bands that used to be either cover bands or house bands. And I had two that hit fairly big. One was, if you want me to mention it, it was Moist.
Nice.
And I had asked both of them at different times to come back once they were bigger. Nickelback came back and played the bar in Maple Ridge as Nickelback when they had the number one song at the time from the Spider-Man movie, and they played for the exact same, like $500, and all they wanted was a slightly larger rider, which was one more case of beer and an extra bucket of chicken from the KFC across the street.
Was that their usual?
We'd always give them KFC and a case of beer. And Chad's big joke was, yeah, fine, we'll come back, but we want an extra case of chicken and an extra case of beer.
So, like, such a simple demand, that's really sweet.
Yeah, no, it was really nice of them, considering Moist, they were, $50,000.
And do you like Nickelback?
He knows I don't, so I can admit it fully. No, I don't like Nickelback. It's not my kind of music at all.
Right.
Don't get me, I'd never, like, you know, when I say I defend Chad Kroeger, I don't ever defend Chad Kroeger's music. I have told him that I think David Bowie would roll over in his grave if he ever had to listen to a Nickelback album.
So. You told him that?
Well, because I'm like, everyone that knows me knows I'm like the biggest David Bowie fan in the world.
Okay.
So yeah, no, I've given him a hard time and he's given me a hard time about it. So because if
does
I
he just tend to take it in stride, or does he like?
He does. He's got like kind of an odd little sense of humor, but he pokes as much fun at himself. He really does.
So, like, do you guys hang out now, or?
So when he moved back to Abbotsford, I saw him a few times, different like parties that he had up at his house, in Abbotsford. So I'd been up to a couple of those, and then things changed a little bit after he got married to Avril Lavigne. So then the parties kind of changed a little bit at the house too.
Well, how did they change?
Well, he used to have some pretty wild parties up at his house, so. And then like, he became more of a family man, let's put it that way.
Yeah. What were his parties like before?
They were just good. Like, he just had tons of people around, and everybody got taken care of. Like, there was always, you know, lots of booze and lots of food, and it was fun, yeah. So Chad, at one of the parties, right a little while after Anchorman came out, the first Anchorman movie,
mm-hmm.
wanted to recreate as much of that movie as possible at his house for a party. So the ongoing Chad Kroeger of jumping in the pool in his underwear, screaming out "Cannonball!"
I haven't seen that movie. Good. What other scenes were there?
Well, there's like the magical unicorn riding, which was just a big stuffed unicorn, but it worked. Trying to get the dog to eat cheese. But we didn't have a dog, so and there was a couple girls that took over for that, and we tried to see if it was possible that they could finish a wheel of cheese.
Oh, my God. So. Where does he live now?
Good question. They sold the place in Abbotsford.
Mm-hmm.
He has a condo in Vancouver, but I know he doesn't live in that, so I'm thinking he probably is just mostly still residing down in the States.
Oh, yeah, it seems like Vancouver is not necessarily the most like music center, but I guess he had a recording studio in his mansion.
In the house, there was the mansion.
Does that not count as a mansion? I don't know what a mansion is. I'm like, that's not even.
I don't know. Like, there's a lot of big houses up in that area.
Oh yeah,
it's not, you know, like, I think, okay, like, let's think mansion right now. If you see the one that Michael Bublé is building right now, that's a mansion.
Is that also in the area?
It's in Burnaby.
Oh, my God. Do you know how to get to him?
You don't want to know that.
Canada Land, this is The Imposter, and I'm Aaliyah Pabani. On this episode, Fatima Dore burns down the house, the feminist book that was banned by feminist bookstores, and music by Morning Coup.
Yeah.
This is a story about a feminist book that got banned in feminist bookstores across the country. There's a few lines of poetry that I read about 10 years ago, and I've been turning it over in my mind ever since. Why do I love most among my heroes those who sail to the perfect edge where there is no social fuel? That's from a Michael Ondaatje poem called White Dwarfs. It's about being a writer, that tension between the chaos of the world and the discipline of the page. But it takes on a new meaning for me when it's also about being a woman. If being a woman in the social world is about being defined, that edge contains the promise of escape. I wanted powerful narratives about women who leave their kids behind, women who are drifters, women who make the wrong decisions over and over again. A friend told me about this book called Crossings by Betty Lambert. It's a book about this young writer named Vicky in early 1960s Vancouver who falls into a physically and emotionally violent relationship with a logger and ex-convict named Mick. To Vicky, the relationship is engrossing and devastating all at once. She gets dragged to the edge of her sanity, and the form of the book seems to mimic the shifting landscapes of her mind. The book starts like this: I took the cats and flew up to the island. But it ends like this: just a brief and dancing minute for the sake of the dark and laughing God. Betty Lambert was born in Calgary to a working-class family. Her mother fell in love with her father when she was 18, and she had a pretty idyllic childhood with her two younger sisters. Here's her sister, Dorothy.
We grew up with parents who were loving, kind, sweet, had a lot of laughter. My dad was very funny. It was a wonderful, wonderful childhood until Daddy built a boat with my cousin Johnny, who was 18, took it out, and they both drowned.
The family was broken apart, and their mother, who was only 30 at the time, took on work cleaning houses to support the three daughters on her own.
We were poor. We often didn't have food. We often had to hide from the milkman behind the sofa, because he'd be banging on the door and we didn't have money to pay him.
And even though their life became pretty spare, their mother made sure she took them to the library. She would take them to look at art. She was driven to educate them so that they'd be able to get out of poverty. Still, Betty's father's death had really taken a toll.
For Betty at 12, it was totally devastating. She adored Daddy so much. And I don't know if she ever recovered. I think it affected her relationships with men. I think it brought a darkness into her life. I believe it changed her at that point. I think it was a very deep wound for her.
In 1957, Betty graduated from the University of British Columbia, and she started working on what would become the only novel she ever wrote, with a main character whose darkness mirrored her own. She finished writing Crossings in 1976, but she couldn't get it published, so she gave it to her friend Brian Brett, and he stashed it away for 3 years. Then Stephen Osborne, this guy who started a small alternative publisher called Pulp Press, he goes to visit Brett. The story goes like this. Stephen Osborne drives out to Sawasin one afternoon, and after a day of drinking whiskey, Brian Brett pulls out the box that contains the manuscript from the back of a closet. Osborne takes it home to Burnaby and sits down at the kitchen table with the intention of reading just a couple of pages, but he ends up reading through the night. He finishes the last page at 7 a.m. the next morning. He becomes the book's first publisher. A young aspiring writer named Claudia Casper was working at Pulp Press at the time.
I moved out to Vancouver from Toronto with a bad boyfriend. We were sleeping on the floor of what was then Pulp Press because we were broke. And there were people, maybe not in the immediate group, but around the group, who would have had... heroin addictions, would have known people who were prostitutes, would have known people who were in knife fights, or people who had died, people who were on the run from the law.
The Vancouver of back then wasn't the Vancouver of smoothies and yoga pants that it is now.
The bars still had entrances, separate entrances for women. Most of the bars were drip joints downtown, there would have still been such a rhythm to the city of loggers and people coming back from mining camps with a lot of money in their pocket, looking for quick, easy times.
Crossings resonated with Claudia. Like Vicky's character, Claudia was also an aspiring writer who was in an abusive relationship with a working class man.
Writers are always hungry for experience, and everything I was going through in that relationship was fodder and fuel for my writing life. So I felt like when I read Crossings, that I was reading a woman looking at that time at the gender dynamics that were going on around me.
Another writer named Anna Kena Schofield found the book decades later. She had immigrated to Vancouver from Dublin, and she was struggling to find a way to relate to the city.
I was trying, I was very miserable for a long time. I'm still fairly pretty, actually, I'm very miserable at the moment. But I had a period where I was even more miserable. But then I learned about BC's labour history. Now, our province has a very, very interesting labour history. And one of the interesting things about City of Vancouver is you can't see the history here. But when I learned about the labour history, I was fascinated. And so then I discovered the 30s and the strikes and the riots. And what made me really curious about all of this was, how come there were all these recessions in BC?
Anna Kena was looking for a novel that captured that history. And she was going through the Canadian reference section at the Vancouver Public Library when she pulled out Crossings, which had been out of print for a while.
I had never read anything quite like this book. You know, it's got great lines like, "There is a hole in the toilet too. You sit there and everything goes down into the stream." Okay, that's not the part I want to read.
Because Betty was a playwright, her dialogue was excellent.
"We are in the kitchen washing up. Paul is snorting into the dishpan. Actually, the language of the lower class is terribly rich in metaphor. It makes one consider the possibility that there is genius in the language. But my God, I hope you're taking notes, Vicky. What a find. At dinner, I have mixed up incubus with succubus, and Paul has corrected me. Don't you mean he's an incubus? What's the difference, Mick says. I beg your pardon, says Paul, affecting to notice Mick for the first time."
The scenes where Vicky is having dinner with her cultured university educated, and she works in a university, so some of her cohorts, that conversation where she really exposes class and a kind of a snobbery that our character Vicky is not buying into, and her relationship with Mick stands against that, is something that's in relief of that.
"Mick finishes his potato. He's a prodigious eater of potatoes. He put them whole into his mouth. Yeah, he says, I knew one once. You mean a Lady Gorgonzola? A what? Says Paul, delighted. A Lady Gorgonzola, says Mick, spearing another potato. Ain't that what you're talking about? Them guys run the boats in Venice. I knew one once, a Lady Gorgonzola. She run this Gorgon up and down the Carnals in Naples. I refuse to look up from my plate. I know Paul is bursting with glee. I believe the word is gondola, says Paul."
The book is full of interactions like this, where these insecure, hand-wringing intellectuals are pitted against Mick's unabashed honesty.
So what I loved about that is, like, this is testament to social class and language, which, of course, was my curiosity, was social class. And the interesting thing, if I recall rightly, is she has this relationship with the professor and she has a relationship with Mick. Mick is it's violent, but in a way, Mick is the more kind of wholesome character. It's not a kind of a one-dimensional kind of a he hit her and he's wrong, which is to say that, of course, if anybody hits anybody, they're wrong, just to clarify that. It acknowledges maybe a possible complexity in that situation.
One of the reasons Crossings is so affecting is that it draws so honestly and directly from Betty Lambert's actual life experience. The similarities are so pronounced that when Betty's daughter Ruth talks about the book, she refers to the character Vicky as my mother.
"My mother's sister and my mother and Mick are all in a an apartment together and an argument breaks out and he rips the phone off the wall. My mother's sister runs down the lane to the gas station to call the police. And then she sees my mom and Nick running down the alley away from the apartment. So I'm pretty sure that is based on an actual event.
Here's the sister, Dorothy.
His name was Nick, not Mick, but a real character, real guy. There was a darkness in her that was drawn to other darkness at times, and he was very dark, but he was also brilliant, and he was charismatic, and he was funny. So a dangerous combination for women. And she often had relationships or affairs with men who could beat her in chess. And, of course, he'd learned to play chess in prison, and he had many years of playing chess in prison. So he was very good at it.
That interplay between abuse and desire didn't really mesh well with the feminism of the 80s, which was concerned with fighting battles for equal pay and was interested in survivor narratives where women unequivocally walked away from abusive men.
There was a big protest that was in the newspapers about her book. My memory is they felt that Vicky, the character in the book, was a victim. And it upset Betty because she was a feminist. She was all for women's rights and, you know, not being a victim. It was upsetting to her that this was happening at the time and that they didn't really understand what she was trying to say in the book.
So, according to Arsenal Pulp Press, as it's now called, and Betty's family members, some feminist bookstores refused to sell Crossings. Everyone seemed to remember this happening, but because a lot of those stores are closed now, it's hard to pin down the details. But it wasn't only feminists who had a hard time with it. So did Betty's mom.
She sent her the book, mom read it, came to the first sex scene, and went to bed, was so upset that she went to bed for 3 days. Then when she got out of bed, she went to the bookstore in Pincher Creek, only one, and bought all the copies so that none of her neighbors would read this terrible book.
4 years after Crossings was published, Betty and her mom were both diagnosed with cancer, a week apart.
Betty said to me, maybe now that we both have cancer together at the same time, it will bring us closer together. And it was so sad because, of course, that didn't happen.
Betty's health took a turn. She had 3 malignant brain tumors that had made her blind, and she contracted pneumonia, so she couldn't speak.
Even though she's blind, she was writing on a yellow pad because she's a writer. That was her passion. And she was still writing, so she wrote this scrawl, even though she was blind, saying, what is the final demand in life? And I said, well, I don't know, Betty, but I'm sure you know. And she put like a question, a Q for that, and then A for answer, and she wrote, more and more and more nostalgia. So she was writing right till the last second, I'd say, and then she took her last breath and died basically in my arms.
Before she died, Betty planned her own memorial service. She wanted it to be in a lecture hall at Simon Fraser University, where she used to teach. At the time, there were rumblings about a possible strike at SFU, and she specified that her memorial should be canceled if the strike went through, because she didn't want anyone to cross the picket line. A couple years earlier, Crossings had been picked up by Viking in New York, which was a huge deal for this small alternative DIY press from Vancouver. Arsenal Pulp Press re-released the book for Vancouver's 125th anniversary, but it's still kind of hard to track down a copy. Back in the late 70s, people weren't ready for Crossings, and they might not be ready for it now. And that's because Betty Lambert laid out a feminism that was rooted in the experiences of the working class, and that still doesn't bode well with the Sheryl Sandberg, lean-in-style feminism of today. Her stark, honest portrayal of abuse isn't something that can be held up at a women's march. It's the kind of book that you feel in your body. And that's why it really sticks with you. This episode of The Imposter is brought to you by Gamefly. Gamefly has over 8,000 games and movies that you can rent for pretty much any game system you can think of, like Xbox One, Xbox 360, all the PlayStations, Wii U, and a bunch of other ones. Okay, so video games are expensive, we know that. With Gamefly, you can get a year of rentals for about the price of two or three games. There are no late fees, and games get sent to you with a pre-addressed envelope so you can return things really easily. And if you rent, say, Mutant Blobs Attack, which is a real game, or Agatha Christie's The ABC Murders, also a real game, and it's so great that you want to keep it in your house forever, you can buy it at a low used game price. Gamefly is offering a premium 30-day free trial for you to try out their service, and you can do that by going to gameflyoffer.com/theimposter. That's gameflyoffer.com/theimposter, and you'll be helping out our show.
Hi, guys. I'm Fatima. I'm here to share a story with you guys. I don't know about you, but I've had, like, a lot of near-death experiences. Like, just to give you a little bit of range, like, one time I almost died because my uncle decided he wanted to get into a fight with Somali militia. It's okay, I survived, guys. Another time I almost got mowed down by AK-47s. Because my sister didn't know when to stop the car. And another time I almost got killed by an angry ostrich named Farhan. Granted, all of these things happened in Somalia. So context, you know? But this story is about the time I almost died in a fire. Spoiler, guys, I survived that too. But it happened when I was a kid. I was just over 10 years old. At that time, it was just a regular Sunday afternoon. I was watching Woody Woodpecker. And in hindsight now, it should have been like some kind of foreshadowing, because that particular episode was about how Woody Woodpecker's house was destroyed by a fire. If my life was a movie, I would at that point be a person in the audience. It's like, oh shit's not going to go well in this story. And then the craziest thing I saw out of the corner of my eye. Now, I should explain the way our apartment was set up is that the balcony itself was fairly long. It was like maybe 15 feet long. And at that time, our apartment was filled with rental furniture, and all of our regular furniture was outside because my mom's brother had his like post-wedding reception party at our place. And my mom didn't want a bunch of like turned up adults messing with her furniture. So I was sitting on some stranger's couch watching Woody Woodpecker. And out of the corner of my eye, in this like very long patio or balcony, I saw a little flicker of something in between my mom's red velvet curtains. I should say they're red velvet. My mom doesn't have great taste in home decor. And so, you know, just regular old Fatima just sauntered up to the curtains, and I pulled them back, and like I couldn't believe what I saw, because what I saw was like a towering wall of fire. At that point, like I reacted like how I would have reacted if I saw like a famous celebrity. Like I was like, oh my God, is that fire? Fire's way hotter in person. And I didn't know how to react. So I kind of just like walked back and forth yelling fire. But this is like an especially funny picture, because when I was a kid, I never swung my arms when I walked. So I walked with like razor straight arms all the time. So I'm like this kid with straight arms walking around like, fire, fire, fire. My family actually nicknamed me a really apt nickname for how I used to walk. In Somali, it was Ninba'ulusita, or translated to English, man carrying heavy bags. I guess they thought lady carrying heavy bags wasn't mean enough. So like, man carrying heavy bags is walking back and forth yelling, fire, fire. There's this big Goliath wall of fire behind me. And my mom finally hears like little echoes of me yelling fire. And she just yells down the stairs. She's like, hey, what's going on? And I'm just like, fire, fire, fire. She just thought it was the teapot on the stove. And so she just kind of started walking at a leisurely pace down the stairs. And the way our apartment was set up was that there was one flight of stairs from the upper level where the bedrooms were, and then just a sort of landing, and then another flight of stairs. So I could see her walking down very leisurely down the first flight of stairs. And then as soon as she saw the crazy wall of fire, she started to pick up speed. My mom at this time was like four or five months pregnant with my next sister. And she starts to pick up speed very quickly. And then she gets to the second flight of stairs, and she gets down the first, like, maybe one or two steps with no problems. And then her foot catches, and then she trips down the rest of the flight of the stairs. And then she bounced, like, do you guys know those plastic sumo suits? Like, she bounced like she was in one of those suits. But then she got back up like she was, like, this, like, very determined, like, football player, and then just, like, pushed me out of the way. I didn't even notice that my little brother crawled all the way to the fire at that point. And then my mom yells, she's like, go to the door! And me and my sister are just, like, looking at my mom sprinting towards the balcony. And she scooped up my brother like he was, like, a football. And now she's, like, the running back just, like, going through the apartment. And she pushes me and my sister out the door. And she closes the door. And maybe a second or 2 seconds after her shutting the door, all of the balcony's glass just shatters. And we can feel it, and we can hear it, and even see, like, a little bit, like, poking through the door. Imagine the sound of, like, very heavy hail just starting out of nowhere. It was the craziest thing. The four of us were all just, like, standing in front of the door in complete shock. And then at that point, our tiny little, like, mustachioed superintendent comes, like, running up to us with a hose. I think his name was Ralph. I think every superintendent is named Ralph. And he came running up to us with the hose, and my mom's like, what are you gonna do with that? There's a fire in there. And he's like, I'm gonna put it out. Don't worry, go downstairs. Everybody's downstairs. And so we walk down the stairs, which was like 14 flights. And we get to the bottom, and there's this huge crowd behind the building itself just looking up at this crazy fire on the balcony. We got cleaned up. We were, like, covered in soot and stuff. Later on, old Superintendent Ralph, that was, like, very determined to fight the fire himself, ended up actually, like, being rescued by this giant firefighter. So he's, like, carrying him like a new husband carries his new wife past the threshold. And so the best part of this story for me is at the end of all of this, after my mom was the one who saved us from everything and Superintendent Ralph had to be saved from the fire by the firefighters, the next couple days there was an article in the Toronto Star, and it said, like, Superintendent saves family of four from fire. That's my story, guys. Hey.
Would you like to join me now?
Yes, between two brown chairs.
So, did you find out what caused the fire?
Yeah,
it was, yes. Like, when is this going to happen?
We did. There was, like, this whole investigative process, and it was because it was, like, the heat of summer in Toronto, and apparently someone had thrown a cigarette from some balcony above us, which you're not allowed to smoke on your balcony.
Is that the law?
At least in our building at the time.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if it's a general law. It should be. No, just kidding. Everybody can smoke fine. But someone threw a cigarette and it landed directly onto, like, our couch and was left smoldering for a couple of nights until, like, it finally caught fire.
Wait. A couple of nights.
Apparently, yeah.
What kind of cigarette was this?
I don't know. I feel like I might be exaggerating that part, but it was, like, it was left smoldering and then it caught fire eventually.
So that was the kind of forensic.
That's exactly what the forensics
I've done that. I've flicked a lot of cigarettes off of balconies.
Yeah. This granted, they were probably not balconies below you that were filled with furniture.
Right. Fair enough. And they were also probably not cigarettes that can burn for years.
Exactly. So everlasting cigarettes.
Usually I'm like close to the filter.
Yeah.
Is that, so how did you come to comedy? Like, how did that happen?
Well, I've always loved comedy. I was like those weird kids that would go to the library and take records out and stuff. And in
wait, like, are you talking about vinyls?
Yeah,
or?
Like actual vinyl records, okay. Or like tapes.
I thought you meant like archival material.
Oh no, yeah. I'd go and read old newspapers just for fun. No, but I would go out and get records. And one of my big comedy idols, which is gonna sound horrible now, guys, but I really loved him back then, was Bill Cosby. But he was like one of my main inspirations for my love of comedy, and I'd followed it for like most of my life, even into my adult life, where I was a big supporter of live comedy. Anytime any one of my favorite comics were in town, I'd go and see them. And then sort of how I got started myself is I went to go see a live amateur pro comedy show in Vancouver.
Ooh.
Yeah. It ended up actually not being even just a regular show. It was like the roast of one of the comics there.
And oh, so it was like a crowd of regulars. It was basically like a birthday party, but with a couple extra people.
Pretty much, yeah. And then I was just thrown into the mix. And it was both eye-opening and horrible. But I did see like a wide breadth of like the actual talent in Vancouver. And the lower end of the spectrum is what inspired me to be like, hey, if these guys are doing it, maybe I can do it too. So then I went to an open mic the next week, and that's when...
The next week you went to an open mic.
Yeah.
What was your set? Like, did you make... What was it about?
It was really bad.
Can you do it right now?
I actually do one of my jokes from that very first set still to this day. And it's it really relates to, like, how there's no black people in Vancouver.
Is that true?
Yeah. Well, there's like a very low percentage. Okay. So you're not from here.
No, I'm not.
But there's like none of us out here.
I know of like one black artist that we were told about.
Yeah.
Who is a comedian from the United States.
Is it Dino Archie?
Yeah.
It's just me and him, guys. There's not many of us.
Just the two of you.
Yeah, now he's back in America, so.
Oh, he left.
Yeah.
Okay, but like, what was the take? Was it like, hey, there's no black people here?
Oh, like on the joke?
Yeah, like what was the... Okay. What was
well, this is a joke. Let's hear I was it. Like, I was hanging around in Vancouver today and I saw another black woman, which is weird because I thought I was on shift in Vancouver today.
That's good. That was your first set?
Yeah. And then I was like, turns out she didn't get the schedule.
That's really good.
And then it was my mom.
It's got three parts to it.
Exactly.
That's like more than one joke that is working.
Yeah, that was like the only joke from my first set that is still in my act.
Give me a bad one.
Oh,
give me
you
something
a bad
that
one?
Failed.
Oh, no.
Maybe the AK-47 story?
Oh, gosh. That's like not a joke. That's I was in Somalia. And my sister was learning to drive stick shift, and like our Somalian cousin was trying to teach her. And so we went to the city to just go to the corner store, and then like she was driving the whole time. And on our way back, like our guards were at the front of the door, and my sister didn't know like how to really drive stick at that point. And so she was trying to stop, and they were yelling at us like, stop, stop, stop. And my sister's like, ah! And I'm just like, this is when we die. We're going to die now. And then there were like three of them lined up just to ready to shoot us down. And then finally, like my cousin, while the car was driving, just he jumped out and he was like, it's us, it's us. Don't shoot us.
I had a friend who told me a story about running over a dog while crossing the border into Mexico. Like he ran over one of the like...
One of the like street dogs?
No, like he ran over the... military dog.
Oh my god.
Yeah. So it had kind of a similar structure to yours. It involved like stop, 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 ran over dog, and he just burned it.
Oh god. Yeah, burn the evidence.
So he's still alive.
This took a dark turn, guys.
I know. Let's just wait for a second for this feeling to settle. Okay, there's no real easy way to ask this question. Do you have a dowry?
Oh, God, I do.
Okay, what is it? Can you describe
it's like
what
a,
it is?
It's like a bunch of camels and goats and some land in Somalia. Or like the dollar equivalent.
Wait.
Such a thing.
How did this happen?
Because there's this traditional thing of my country where when you get married, there's like this bride prize. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's from years of like tribalism. And it's like one of the few things that's carried over into like our modern culture. And supposedly that's what's going to happen when I get married. My mom doesn't even care at this point. She's like, if that's not enough incentive for you, then I don't know what is.
So. Is that like a pretty sweet haul?
It should be, yeah, actually.
Yeah, like how many camels is it?
It's like 60 camels.
60 camels.
Yeah.
I would marry you for that.
I know.
I would marry you for 2 camels. I really like camels.
Camels are a big hassle, though. They, like, spit everywhere, and they're smelly.
Yeah, but they also store water.
Do you know how hard it is to find camel parking in the city, though?
No.
It's hard. I don't know either. I'm full of shit.
So what is the, like, what is the situation? Do you have someone there that is, like, watching
your
dowry?
Well, that's the thing, is that it's not actually... like these camels theoretically exist, but there isn't like some camel herd person watching them. It's just like what my family must pay to my suitor upon us marrying, like the dollar equivalent.
Okay.
We do have some goats. We got lots of goats.
And they're just chilling.
They're just chilling.
Are you concerned about what's going on with them? Like with if the they goats? All die?
Yeah, they all, I've named them all and I constantly worry about them. No, actually, I do have some concern, like I would for any other animal, but I don't really think about them much until people bring them up.
That's fair. I mean, one thing that I think that's cool about that is, you know that YouTube video where they have a bunch of goats jumping on a trampoline together?
Oh my God, I love that video.
You can do that. Yeah. Like, you are the only one probably in this room who can recreate such
a
video.
Who can make that happen, yeah.
Which I think, again, like, do you want to get married?
You have to get in line behind my boyfriend.
Oh, shit, yeah. Well, where is he? I mean...
He is currently in Vancouver, probably watching wrestling.
Okay, he's watching wrestling and you just performed, and he's not out here. It's like less than an hour drive.
I mean, like, he's not... He's lost points today.
Yeah, seriously. This guy's like a half camel dude.
Yeah, he actually is... It's funny because my boyfriend is actually on the record labor that Chad Kroeger created.
What?
Yeah, it's like, I feel like this is...
What is the record label?
It's 604 Records.
Does he like Chad Kroeger? Does he know Chad Kroeger? Does he want to talk about it on the show?
I think he's met him only once now, a very short while ago.
Okay.
So I don't think he has much of experience with Mr. Kroeger.
Okay.
But he's on his record label.
So you actually moved to Vancouver from Toronto.
Yeah, where there's a lot more black people.
Yeah. Is there an advantage here that you were chasing?
Well, I moved here with my family, so I didn't have much of a choice.
That's fair.
It was a very like stark contrast as far as like environments go, because we went from like Toronto, where there's like a very big amount of different people from all kinds of walks of life and is very diverse, and then we moved to Chilliwack. We went to one day of high school, and it was the weirdest experience because it was just like the whole school was just white kids, and then we were the weird black Toronto kids.
Okay.
It was the only point in my life where I went from like a nobody to like instant cool.
So you were well received.
Yeah, we were very well received.
Huh.
It was very exciting for those Chilliwack kids.
What decade was this? Because I grew up in like an all white town that was certainly not cool.
This is like in 2001 when we moved
here. Okay, yeah, I was a little earlier than that.
I was a wee baby.
So do you hate it here? Like,
I did hate it here for a long time when back then, because it was like very different. We actually ended up settling in Burnaby, which is where I grew up for most of my like teenage life. And I actually ended up loving it and getting used to the sort of like hometowny, small town feel of that that one municipality in Vancouver.
You sound like you're reading off their website.
Yes. Welcome to the beautiful municipality of Burnaby, where forests and people alike live together.
That was really good. That was a convincing riff. Thank you.
You're welcome. Hire me, City of Burnaby.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Fatima Doré. That was Fatima Doré, Dorothy Bevington, Ruth Lambert, Claudia Casper, Anna Kana Schofield, and Brad Ross. The music on this episode was by Morning Coup, led by Chandra Melting Tallow, and How You Remind Me by Nickelback. Thank you to CIVL Radio and the excellent podcast Cited for bringing us out to Abbotsford. And thanks to all the people at Arsenal Pulp Press in Vancouver. The Imposter is produced by Kevin Sexton. Our theme music is by Nathan Burley and Carl Dider. Follow us on Twitter at Imster, that's I-M-P-S-T-R, and you can follow me at Aaliyah Pavani. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/canaland, and if you like the show today, subscribe on iTunes. Do it right now. Show's not ending until you show me that you did it. The doors of this building are locked. Thanks for coming out.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.